Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz, and joining me on this rainy Johannesburg day, is Johannesburg a day? No. On this rainy Friday, is Clinton Matos.
Hello, everybody.
And Robin Lichetti.
Howdy.
How was that storm last night? This is something that pretty much everybody in Joburg is saying this morning, I'm pretty sure.
It knocked out my lights at like 1 a.m. and it woke me up, so it was a... It wasn't scary, but it was a bit hectic.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, winter is coming, so is the rain.
What do you mean? We're not Cape Town. There's no rain in Johannesburg in the winter.
Global warming, Brendan.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. As an aside, I'm actually watching this series on Netflix called Snowpiercer, which is about the world like freezing because of global warming and man killing Earth. And
Isn't that connected to the movie?
It's based off of the movie, but it's directed by the guy who did Parasite. So it's very, very good. I highly recommend it if you haven't watched it, because the movie was awful.
What do you mean the movie was awful?
Compared to the series, honestly.
Well, then the series has to be like the best series ever made.
It's really good.
I really like the Snowpiercer movie. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to say the name of my brother. The movie was very, very good.
I disagree. Watch the series. I think it's way, way better than the movie. But we're getting sidetracked here. Let's chat about what happened this week. Robin, what do you have from us? Some news from India.
Yeah, not great news, unfortunately. India, like a lot of countries across the world, are dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, and they're dealing with a massive wave of infections at the moment. At the weekend, there were estimated over 300,000 new cases for COVID-19. But that's not really the kind of crux of the story here. It's kind of how the government has been handling things with regards to social media. As we mentioned, there has been a massive surge in infections, and people online are kind of commenting about what's happening in the country and criticizing the government as to how it's kind of handled the pandemic thus far. And for that criticism, instead of kind of looking at itself and kind of seeing how it can potentially do things better, for some reason, the Indian government seems to be targeting social media, where a lot of these posts are being shared. They're specifically targeting Facebook and Twitter. Earlier in the week, they asked them to remove posts that criticize the Indian government. And then a couple of days ago, the hashtag Resign Modi, for anyone who doesn't know, Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, he's a rather controversial figure, and he's also come under criticism as well. So that hashtag was being used on Facebook, and Facebook chose to hide posts with that hashtag for roughly 3 hours or so and say that they did so by mistake. How that happens, I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure if it is an algorithm that kind of automatically handles those kind of procedures, or there is a human moderator that's actually looking at the hashtags and then choosing what to hide and what not to hide. But the fact that it happened, it doesn't really help to dispel the rumors that India has a lot of influence on how Facebook operates in its country. Their former chief in the region had ties to the same political party that Modi is a part of, and was quite outspoken as far as criticism about the party was concerned. So it's a very kind of tenuous situation right now in India. And we start to see now that perhaps the same rules that apply to governments in the West doesn't necessarily apply to governments in Asian countries. We've seen, for example, in Myanmar, I think it was back in 2018, there was obviously huge uproar with regards to how Facebook handled things there. And India isn't at that stage yet. But the fact that the current government has so much influence as to how these social media platforms are policing content is rather concerning. So as far as kind of free speech and being able to share information freely in India, that seems to be taking a bit of a hit right now, when really the government should be focusing on how it's going to be handling the pandemic.
I just want to know how you accidentally block a hashtag. Like, I really want to know how the PR department spins that. Like, Jeff was just testing out what would happen if we were to ban this really random set of characters and it just happened to be activated, like
it's always the same, eh? It's a mistake because we got caught.
And the kind of concerning part of that is that they told multiple international publications that it was just a mistake.
Yeah.
There wasn't any kind of reason behind it or why it could have happened.
I mean, what?
Two words. It was a mistake.
Why was it a mistake? Like, what? How do you make that mistake? Because clearly then you either had a template to ban that that thing, or somebody had sought out that hashtag and wanted to ban it, but were told not to and then accidentally did. I mean, either of those scenarios doesn't paint Facebook in the best light.
Development at the moment.
What's stopping them from accidentally disabling their 2.8 billion active users each month? You know, like
A few buttons is the answer.
I like to think that there's a big red button in
for
Mark
every
Zuckerberg's
country,
desk,
they have a big button,
and then he just slams it, and then Facebook closes.
Like they probably, when they have a dispute with the government, they probably send the government a picture of their button. It's like, who is it? Australia, who had a problem
with
Australia
already.
Instead of sending a proper worded email, they just send the picture. They don't even attach any words. It's just a picture of a button.
Okay, so let's move on. This week, Uber Go announced that drivers who make use of Uber Go, if you don't know what that is, it's a option for price-sensitive customers where drivers are allowed to use hatchbacks instead of saloon cars. So this week they launched a brand new offering with Move, which gives drivers access to a Toyota Agios. I have no idea how to say that. Agios? Agios? Ages? A-G-Y-A-S. Toyota hatchback, thank you, Robin, from as low as 1,599 Rand per week for a weekly rental. And you can also pay, or you can pay 1,950 Rand per week for a drive to own deal, which sounds like a decent deal. Obviously, this depends, though, on a number of things. It depends on how many rides you're getting. Especially with Uber Go, which is lower priced and generally only travel short distances. So, yeah, I don't know how well this is going to play out.
Sorry, Brendan.
Yes.
What's the term for that?
What do you mean?
The length of the contract.
So they didn't outline that specifically. Well, I do know that there is no deposit required. You get free maintenance and free insurance. That's as much as Uber shared with us.
And sorry, you said 1,000 something per week.
Yes, so it's 1,599 Rand per week for the weekly rental, and 1,950 Rand per week for drive-to-own deals.
But that's 6,000 a month.
So let me put this into perspective at the moment. So this is anecdotal, but I've heard this from several Uber drivers. So generally what happens is there's an option within Uber for you to operate a fleet of vehicles. So essentially what you can do is you can create a company and you hire a few drivers and they lease your vehicles from you to use with Uber. The problem is that a lot of these fleet services charge in excess of 2,000 Rand a week for the use of a vehicle. So in terms of what the quote-unquote market is charging, this is kind of comparative, and you have the option to actually own your vehicle at the end of the day. I am a bit hesitant to say that this is a great option, because as I mentioned, Uber Go is generally for shorter trips for passengers who aren't paying a lot of money, and to make up 1,000, let's call it 2,000 bucks a week to pay off your vehicle, and then still make money on top of that, I think that this is going to butt some heads. Obviously we don't know though. However, saying that, I know that Uber has tried something like this before with vehicle finance, and that's something that it no longer does, or at least from what I can see on its website, there doesn't seem to be a way, through Uber at least, where you can apply for vehicle financing. So, yeah, we'll just have to see how this goes, because I don't know. It feels like a good thing, but obviously the proof is in the pudding, and we'll have to see whether this benefits any drivers at the end of the day. But as you say, Clinton, they are high amounts. They are definitely high amounts.
Robin, you probably know more about cars than anyone in this call. Does that seem right to you? Because to me, as a cheapskate, it doesn't seem right.
Yeah, as a fellow cheapskate, it seems like it might be actually more or less expensive, rather, to just go and get the car yourself and try and go through Toyota's own financing. If I take one of the highest tier was essentially 2,000 Rand a week.
Yes.
That's 8,000 a month. So I see the only benefit there would be the fact that you're waiving the deposit and the insurance costs.
Yeah.
But apart from that, to me, at least it sounds like it's actually as expensive, if not potentially more expensive than going the normal route and kind of absorbing those costs yourself.
See, the other side of this, though, is I don't think a lot of drivers, especially, are able to go the traditional finance route because you're part of the gig economy.
Self-employed, it's so difficult to get financing.
Exactly, and especially through Uber, where you don't have a fixed income that you can expect every month. So I think this is a decent solution, but whether it will work, I don't know. And like you say, it is more expensive, but then you have the benefit of not having to have go through the process of vehicle financing and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, we will have to see whether the solution takes off. And I'd be curious to see in a year's time if this offer is even still available. Because as I mentioned, there have been times where Uber has offered drivers the opportunity to finance their cars through Uber with help from various financial service providers in South Africa. But those don't seem to exist anymore. So, I mean, well, it's a wait and see, as always. Moving on. Clinton, you've got some news about good old games.
Yes, well, GOG. I think they actually get angry at you if you call them good old games. But that aside, they released basically a huge infographic about the statistics attached to the store. To me, reading it, it seems like, hey, we had a really good year last year, so look at all our big numbers. I mean, just to give you some quick ones, their monthly active users went up 208%. New user registrations up 392%. Monthly active users on GOG Galaxy, their client, went up 805%. So all of this has gone up. All their sales have gone up. Everything's gone up. But I just want to touch on two things here. One is that all of this probably went up because of Cyberpunk 2077. It was a train wreck at launch and it's still kind of a train wreck, but it's been patched and it's gotten better over time. But it sold so many units. In 2020 alone, it sold 13.7 million. And you have to remember that it was released on 10th December. So it made 13.7 million in a month, less than a month, which is bonkers. That's so many sales. So they haven't said in this graph, you know, how much of this is due to Cyberpunk. But what I really want to talk about is little old South Africa, because they put up a breakdown of where their market split is. And market split is on game sales, not on registered users, not on how many people view the store. This is sales. And South Africa didn't even make it on the list. It's bundled into 7% rest of the world, which I think most of us would assume. I think if Steam did a similar thing, we would also be, you know, a small single-digit percentage for rest of the world. But I was really hoping they would put us separately and say South Africa is 0.1%, just so we could feel special, you know. For those wondering about the rest of the world, Europe, they just say the whole of Europe is 49%. North America, 34%, Asia, 6%, and Australia and New Zealand, they bundled them together, 4%. I wonder if Europe, if they included the UK. I can't see in this infographic if they did.
Probably. So,
So yeah, they haven't Brexited yet, so.
It's interesting that GOG really seems to be on the up and up, but I don't know what this graph is going to look like in 2022 when they don't have Cyberpunk. Maybe this year they'll release Cyberpunk Game of the Year Edition, laugh, laugh. I think The Hard Times, which is like The Onion, but for games, I think it was them, they put out an article that says Cyberpunk will release a Game of the Year Edition. You get it? Not the Game of the Year, a Game of the Year Edition. It works better in print. Anyway, everyone should check out these stats quick, and they should see where they fall. Before we go on to the next topic and the main topic, I just want to ask, do you guys even use GOG? Because I used it once to play a game called Nox, which was a Diablo ripoff that I played when I was young. Oh my God. Did you guys hear that?
Yes. We heard your hearty dar. The rain is over. We can emerge.
That actually gave me a fright to tell you right in my room.
This is not being edited out of the podcast, just so you know.
So I only played that game, and then I've only really logged into GOG to claim like free games. Do you guys use the platform at all?
To be honest, the last time I used it was to claim F1 2015 when it was available for free. And that was it. I mean, I'm signed up for the newsletter, which just gets marked as read and never looked at again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really use it. I just think, like, for me, it's just, why do I need another storefront? You know, like, I'm going to buy a game, I'm just going to spend at the easiest place, which is more often than not Steam.
Well, a big reason that they don't like to be called good old games anymore and they just want GOGs because they do now focus on new games and offering it without DRM, which I think is their big selling point.
I mean, I think it's also the fact that they don't have localized pricing. That's always a boon, like to have. It's a boo rather to have to pay in dollars, especially when you have something like Steam and the Epic Game Store, which have localized pricing. Yeah, so I mean, it's just for me, it's just another storefront that I don't really need.
And you, Robin, I know you don't game much at all on PC, but have you ever gone on there and like looked for a game you played as a kid?
I've checked it out a couple of times, but never tempted enough to follow through with a purchase. Like I said, I'm a console guy, so the storefront doesn't really appeal that much to me.
Well, you may want to change your tune after our little discussion we're going to have here. Do you want to introduce us to...
Actually, that does segue very nicely. So, this week, Robin reviewed Returnal, which is the latest PlayStation 5 exclusive to hit latest PlayStation exclusive to hit the consoles. Robin, I think before we get into the meat, what was Returnal like? Is it any good? Is it a fun game? I know it's like a roguelite type of game where dying is permanent and all that sort of stuff. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so overall, a really solid game. My initial interest kind of peaked in it because of kind of the death loop mechanic of it. It also seemed initially to be akin to Hellblade as far as kind of the psychological element of the protagonist was concerned. Unfortunately, that didn't really pan out as I hoped. But overall, it was a solid game. We rated it 8 out of 10. Most other publications are doing the same. Whether or not you're actually going to want to play it again after you've completed the main story is another question. I'm not too sure if it has lasting appeal. But the kind of footnote, the kind of final verdict element that we wrote about was around the price. And it is a PS5 exclusive, so it's not coming to the PS4 at the time of writing, or rather at the time of recording. It costs 1,369 Rand, which you might as well just pull 1,400 Rand at this point. And that's for the standard edition. It goes up in price to around about the 1,600 Rand mark. For the deluxe edition, which includes a couple of in-game extras like costumes for your main character, Celine. But I think, yeah, that's kind of my problem with the game. It's that not necessarily that the kind of the gameplay itself is necessarily for every type of gamer. It's the fact that it is really, really expensive. And to ask someone to pay 1,400 Rand for a game that could be hit or miss, it just doesn't sit right with me. So I couldn't give it higher than 8 out of 10. Other than that, mechanics, look and feel, all really solid across the board. it's just not necessarily as memorable as some might hope.
And that's actually what we're talking about today, is the cost of games. So ahead of the PlayStation 5's launch last year, PlayStation announced that some titles would be getting a price increase. And titles specifically on the PlayStation 5 would be getting a price increase. And we're starting to see that effect now. I'm sure that games have been costing a lot up until this point, but now we're starting to see a game that is probably not going to appeal to a very wide audience, retailing for 1,400 Rand with the big marketing push behind it that we see from so many games. I mean, I think the most recent example of that is Outriders, which just pushed the marketing, dialed it up to 11, and the resulting game has split people. It's a fun little romp, but if you encounter bugs like the inventory wipe that Clinton and I were talking about before we started recording, it's likely not going to leave a sweet taste in your mouth. And asking folks to part ways with the amount of money that is being demanded of gamers now just seems like somebody needs to stand up and say, hey, can we talk about this? So that's what we're going to do. So let's chat for a bit. 1,400 Rand. Is that too much for a game? Robin, let's start with you.
Short answer, yes. especially for the PS5 exclusive parts. So if you take, for example, something that's coming out soon, Resident Evil Village, that retails for 1,250 if you look at the console version, regardless of what platform you're playing on. Namely PS5 and Xbox Series X and S. For a PS5 exclusive, you're paying 1,369 Rand. So that 120 Rand difference is purely for the fact that it's a PlayStation exclusive. I don't get that. I'm not too sure where that money goes or what that money is for. So to my mind, one, these games are already exorbitantly expensive. And two, you're adding a premium to the current high price where I don't see the value in it. So yeah.
I mean, let's just also like state the obvious here. As a PlayStation exclusive, it should arguably be the cheaper of the two games because you have to have a PlayStation in order to play it. So I've already paid the price of entry, which was buying your console. Now I have to pay more to play the game that I can only play on your console. That doesn't make too much sense in my mind.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, for me at least, if it was a PlayStation exclusive, I'm not seeing the extra value that I'm having to pay extra year, because I think the only element that might be different to, say, a non-PlayStation exclusive game is the features around the DualSense controller. And that's not necessarily a PlayStation exclusive either. A lot of titles where shooting is involved, I remember, what is it, Call of Duty last year, that had a lot of features around the DualSense controller.
Destruction All-Stars also had it where, like, the brake, quote-unquote, pedal, the left trigger, was harder to push in to simulate braking.
Yeah, so it's like, what is the difference here? Because Call of Duty was a cross-platform title. Destruction All-Stars was exclusive. So can someone show me what the difference is here? Because I'm not seeing it at the moment.
I mean, I'm sure we'll get to this, but also the fact that PlayStation exclusives don't seem to be all that exclusive anymore, given that we've had all of David Cage's games come to PC. We had Horizon Zero Dawn last year. What was the other one, Clinton, that you mentioned recently?
Days Gone is coming out soon on PC.
Days Gone is coming to PC. So, I mean, it's like, okay, so I'm paying more for the exclusivity of playing the game. I'm struggling to understand how this whole situation is good at all. Like, yeah, it just makes no sense to me. Clinton, do you think that 1,400 Rand is too much for a game?
So people probably got my answer when I called myself a cheapskate when we were talking about cars. But yes, that is absolutely bonkers, and I cannot believe people put up with it. And something I also want to talk about quick, it's in relation to all of this, is that Nintendo for a long time in South Africa has been charging ridiculously high prices for its games. When the PS4 and Xbox One were the kings of the consoles. I think a lot of the time, local people were expecting to pay between like $800 and $1,000 for a new $60 game. And the Nintendo Switch, especially after the big price increase, which I've written about on the site before, where the cost of Nintendo hardware went through the roof, the games were about $1,100 to $1,200. And just today, I mean, as we're speaking, on the 30th of April, new Pokemon Snap was released, and that, like Returnal, is exclusive to a console. It's only on Nintendo Switch. It is $1,129. I'm on the site here. New Super Mario Party, which came out 2 years ago in 2018. Sorry, 3 years. It is closer to two if you do the math, but it's a 2018 game, and it was just updated with online multiplayer. That's right. It was just updated with online multiplayer. That game is still 1,129 Rand because Nintendo games don't go down in price like a lot of other games do. Monster Hunter Rise, it's a very popular game right now. It might be the most popular game right now. Nintendo Switch exclusive. It is coming to PC later, but right now it's an exclusive and it's 1,129 Rand. And it's not just when we talk about PlayStation charging 1,400 Rand for their exclusives. We should just keep in mind that Nintendo has always charged a very high premium, but now PlayStation is leapfrogging them and charging even more, which is, it's just crazy. So do I think it's worth it? Not at all. And Brendan is going to answer this question for us as well, but I also want to come back and talk about Xbox. And I'm not an Xbox fan, but I think in South Africa, the Xbox might be the most cost-effective console in the country. I was going to say on the country, on the continent. Brendan, what do you think about all of this? Because I think you and I, we have a unique perspective because we almost exclusively play on PC. I think, Robin, you on console, I don't want to say you're conditioned to pay more, but when you look at a game that's a few hundred Rand and you might think, okay, that's decent, but Brendan and I, you know, we go on Steam and something is 75% off and it's like 50 Rand and we're like, maybe we'll wait for an 80% off sale.
So I think that 1,400 Rand is a lot of money. But it all depends on what the game is, right? So for instance, like, would I pay 1,400 Rand for Cyberpunk? Hell no. Especially not in the condition that it was released in. However, would I pay 1,400 Rand for a game that was 100% complete from beginning to end? I wouldn't need to buy additional patch or additional expansions, additional DLC to fully enjoy the game. I might consider it, but unfortunately, that's not how games are made these days. You buy the base game, and then you get access to like the loading screen, and it's like, okay, give us more money, please. And that's not how games are made these days. There are immeasurable amounts of microtransactions in games, and it's not just free-to-play games. And there are games like, and Ubisoft does this so often, and it annoys me so much, is that you have these microtransactions that are pushed in front of you. You should buy this. You should buy this. This is a special event, and you'll look completely unique in a world where it's only you. And they push these microtransactions on you as a way to kind of say, well, you know, games are expensive to make, so we need to augment them with these extra transactions, which are designed to lure people in and designed to make you want to spend your money. Let's not beat around the bush. I mean, they, like, the loot box mechanics are incredibly scummy, and I think we all know this at this stage. But I mean, it's just this constant flog of upselling you once you've purchased the game. It's not just like, hey, I'm buying the game. It's, hey, buy this expansion, buy this DLC, buy the special event item. Like, there's just so much that goes into it. I mean, if I have to go back and look at how much I spent on Destiny, which is something that Steam lets you do, I'm pretty sure I'd have a heart attack, right? Like, I've done it for Dota, which was a free-to-play game that I used to play back in the day, and that was one of the reasons I stopped playing that game, because I had spent an immeasurable amount of money on digital items, microtransactions, because I was like, well, you know, I love this game, and it's, you go back and look at it, and you're like, well, I've spent way too much than I can justify on this game. So, like, I understand that games are expensive to make and that cost needs to come from somewhere. But on the same token, if we're moving to a point where games are costing $1,400 and up, because let's face it, they're not going to get cheaper. They're just going to go up from here. Then we need to have a conversation about all the other stuff that is now working in tandem with games.
Yeah.
Microtransactions need to be kicked to the curb. DLC needs to be included in the game. Expansions need to be included in the game. You can't just sell me base access to a game anymore for that price.
This is what really irritates me, because I distinctly remember in the PS3 and the Xbox 360 era, microtransactions started to become a thing, right? And every time it was brought up, these executives, they kept saying to us, listen, we know you don't like it, but if we don't do this, we will have to take the $60 games and charge $70, $80 for them, right? So we're going to supplement our income with microtransactions, and then we won't raise the base price of the game. And even though we might not have agreed with it, that's what they did. But now we have the worst of both worlds. Mm. We have the microtransactions. We have the expansion passes. We have the in-game stores. We have loot boxes. We have all this crap. And now they've also increased the base price of the game. And then, like Robin said, Returnal also has a special edition where you can get more tat. They gave us a choice, and then they just slapped us in the face and did both bad things.
Yeah, it seems like we've let this get away from us. And I say we, I mean, so many people have complained about this.
I complained at every opportunity. Let me say that.
I mean, like, and it's hard. It is one of those arguments that's very difficult to navigate, because, like, a free-to-play game, I can understand microtransactions in that aspect, right? You have skins and as Clinton calls it, tats that you want to sell to the person. And if they buy it, it's not something that affects the outcome of the game or anything like that. It's just like, oh, cool, this person spent $50 on this skin. What a moron. But it's infected every part of gaming to the point where, like, I almost expect NBA 2K, whichever version we're on, to be fueled by microtransactions, right? And it's kind of like become the status quo. And as you said, Clinton, now we have the worst of both worlds. We have expensive games littered with microtransactions, and this doesn't seem to be getting any better, except it is getting a little bit better, he said, building up to the next part of this. So I think we've fawned over Game Pass enough times in this podcast for folks to understand that we really like it. Clinton mentioned as well that Xbox is probably the most cost-effective console for folks to make use of these days, especially if you're in South Africa, because you have access to Xbox Game Pass, which gives you access to brand new games a lot of the time, and hundreds of games that you probably will never be able to play. And it's really, really good value for money at 99 Rand per month on PC. I'm not 100% sure what the cost is on console.
It's also 100 Rand on console, Brendan.
Okay, all right. So it's
100 Rand for both. And if I'm not mistaken, I apologize. It's a loud keyboard. I think Game Pass Ultimate, which is console and PC, and then you also get a few other bonuses, is 200. Sorry, I'm just... No, it's only 149.
Yeah.
So... And your first month is 15 Rand. So yeah.
it's really just best value for money, really. But now the person who's been left behind in this race is Sony. But recently there have been reports that Sony is working on a subscription service. And that would be very good. However, is it worth Sony doing that, given that what is really going to offer now? I mean,
no, because Xbox isn't just Microsoft games. They now own ZeniMax, which is Bethesda, and a lot of other studios. And now they partnered with EA to offer EA Play through Xbox. So if Sony comes around, what are they going to offer? And I'm sure we'll get into this, but I'm really worried that this is going to become like Netflix again, where, oh, I really want to play this game, but it's Xbox has the rights to get it through the streaming service and not PlayStation. I'm really worried about that.
So I want to throw this question to Robin, because he is the PlayStation gamer among us. Robin, what would you like to be in a PlayStation game subscription service?
So the Game Pass, I guess, offering is really tempting to me. The reason why I've kind of stuck with PlayStation all these years was the fact that Sony had better exclusives than Microsoft ever did, in my opinion. That whole idea is changing now, as we're seeing with some of the PS5 titles at the moment. For me to kind of stick with it, I would say they have to try to match what Game Pass is offering as far as availability to content goes. Whether or not that's a feasible model as far as the executives consider things, I'm not too sure. But South Africa has obviously been PlayStation country for many decades now.
Yeah.
That's going to change the more the people see that Game Pass is the better bang for your buck. South Africans are very loyal, but at the same time, South Africans love a deal.
Yeah.
And Game Pass right now is the best deal. Only way that PlayStation can hold its dominance, in my view, is if they match Game Pass as a total digital offering.
I don't think people, just to touch on that, I don't think people really understand how much Sony is favored over Xbox in South Africa. Now, unfortunately, I can't just provide you data about this because the importers who this matters to don't share it at all. The third-party retailers, I think they're under NDA not to share it, but I'm willing to bet that if you took 10 people who own a console and you asked them, do you have a PlayStation or Xbox, I'm willing to bet it's more than 50% going towards like 70 or 80%.
Well, I mean, anecdotally, we can look at the sales of PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series in South Africa. I mean, PlayStation 5 sold out instantaneously, and
it sells out every time it comes on sale.
Exactly. And Xbox doesn't have the same problem. I mean, it does still have that problem. Like, consoles do move. I'm not saying they don't move at all. Please don't get me wrong. But they move far slower than the PlayStation consoles move. So, I mean, it's anecdotal evidence, but I mean, like, I can speak for myself and say that I grew up around PlayStation consoles. PlayStation 1, Big Gray had it. Then the slimmer version moved on to PlayStation 2, moved on to PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4. I mean, I've had pretty much every generation of PlayStation, and Xbox, I had an Xbox 360. That was it. Never had another one and never wanted to have another one. It's anecdotal, but I think it's safe to say that South Africa is a PlayStation country.
And let's not forget, another thing here is the price of the consoles themselves. Microsoft offers the Xbox Series S. Now, I could write a whole feature-length article about why that might not be the best purchase because of, quote-unquote, future-proofing and stuff like that, but I just want to point out that you can get an Xbox Series X for, I think, the official price is, I think, $7,000. But, I mean, I've seen there's one here for $6,200. I think it's sold by Nedbank. And with the price difference, you could get like 5 years of Xbox Game Pass for the money. And you could then, one, you never need to buy a game again. Two, you won't need to upgrade because it's not a PC. Four, like 10,000 Rand, or even less than that, actually, you could have a single purchase console experience at 1080p that you never have to put more money into. You never have to worry about upgrading. It's just set. Now, people complain to me about that. There are worries that the Series S won't be able to run some 1080p games at the proper resolution. I understand. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff going into that. You might run out of space. It only has 512 gigs. I understand. But the value proposition there is so good. If for very, very casual gamers who don't care about all of this, and they just want to sit down and play a game every now and again, I don't see anything that can match the Series S and Game Pass. It's just such good value.
Yeah, and I mean, that's even looking at like PC, because if you want to build a computer in South Africa these days, good luck. May the odds be ever in your favor.
But the problem is, it wasn't just now that we have the problem with PCs. You know, I get, it's a bit disingenuous. All these YouTubers always say, oh, we built a PC that has the same power as a PlayStation or Xbox before the shortages. But you can't do that in South Africa because PC parts are so expensive. But the PlayStation and the Xbox always had proper regional pricing. It had a worldwide recommended retail price, and the PC parts didn't. You've never been able to build a console equivalent in South Africa. You've always had to accept that I will pay through the nose for the hardware and I will not make the money back, but then I get the games cheaper and then I get now free games through Epic and other stuff like that. You could never build an equivalent. And now with the shortages, the difference between them in terms of entry price is ridiculous. Mm. And now I always suggested to people to build and buy and build their own PC because it's like an investment. You're paying a bit more now, even if it's twice as much as a console, but you're going to reap those benefits when you have a powerful machine that can do anything you want, including gaming, and you'll get the cheap games. But now my brother came to me the other day, who's a very casual gamer, and he says he wants to build a PC to play racing games, and I said, you can't. You just can't. Even the second-hand market has people pricing their hardware so high that it's impossible to get into unless you have stacks of cash.
Yeah, I mean, console is definitely the way here, but that also bleeds into the issue of, okay, so Game Pass is great, but you don't always have access to the latest games, right? I mean, I think the most recent one is Outriders, which was announced a week before. So if you had pre-ordered it, you had enough time to cancel your pre-order, pretty much.
And first-party games always launched the same day.
Yeah,
as
so
the regular release.
So I mean, you don't always get access to every single game, especially if you're on Game Pass for PC. So there are going to be instances where folks want to buy a game and play it at release. And if I'm speaking about myself, I don't really care about how much a game costs. If I'm going to play it, I'm going to buy it. And I think that's where the problem sort of comes in, because you want that instant gratification. You want to play a game at the same time as everybody else, just like you want to watch Game of Thrones at the same time as everybody else, so that you can participate in the conversation online. And, I mean, it kind of feels like game publishers are pushing our hand here and kind of saying, well, I mean, you've had a nice run enjoying games for a fairly fair price. Not that 800 Rand is a fair price for some games. Some games it is, obviously, but some games it really isn't. And it just feels like there needs to be more to this, you know? Like, I understand that games cost a lot of money to make, but if you're not going to be giving people a good product, then they're just going to not play your game eventually. And I think the gaming industry, or the gamers rather, are getting fed up with the status quo at the moment, because we keep having launches of games that are just appalling. Outriders most recently, that game still has issues. That game still has a bug that deletes a character's progress when they log in through no fault of their own. I mean, it's just, it confuses me how these games are able to charge this price, but there's no pushback. Like, I know this analogy has been used many times, but you wouldn't buy a car that only has three wheels or half an engine. So why do we accept this with games?
No, it's a feature, Brendan. It's a bike.
I mean, PlayStation is definitely a company that I appreciate, because it pulled Cyberpunk from the store and said, no, we're not letting you sell this game to people. But I mean, so many places won't do that. Is the retailer at your local mall going to pull a game because it's broken? They probably don't even know, nor do they care. They've got product to sell. They're going to sell the product. And I think as a community of gamers, we need to start demanding better from developers and publishers. I'm not asking people to break their backs, mind you. I'm not asking for like 1,000 weeks of crunch, because that also needs to change. The entire industry is ripe for a revolution. Viva la revolution. But I think that this price change needs to be the point at which we start that change. Or am I just am I airy fairy here?
You actually brought up something that I also want to mention when we talk about the cost of games, which is development cost. That is, how much are you paying people in a company to make a game? And Robin, you and I actually spoke about this months ago now, and I'm just remembering it. Another thing, again, this was during the PS3 and the Xbox 360 era when they started putting in all this microtransaction BS and expansion passes. They said, listen, games have cost $60. Again, we're talking about America because a lot of the pricing affects us. Games have cost $60 since the 90s or even before then. And after all these years, every time we try and increase it, there's pushback. And people, on top of that, you know, it hasn't kept up with the rate of inflation or whatever. It has become increasingly more expensive to make these games because people want photorealistic graphics. They want online multiplayer. They want free updates for their multiplayer, stuff like that, right? Sure. But those, I don't buy those at all for two big reasons. One, there's more people buying games than ever before, right? You have to match, you know, it's cost and supply. There are so many people buying your game at $60 that, you know, do you want 10 people buying your game at $60 or do you want one person buying your game for $80? What do you want? You're going to make more money with more people buying it. The second thing is, a lot of the cost that went into those games back then was for expensive cartridges. Back then, you basically had to sell a physical medium to put the game on. And now, all the sales are done online, mostly. I know a lot of people still like physical media, but you have to accept that online is the way to go, and that's where a lot of the market is going. And again, people say, yes, but what about server costs, Clinton? What about the consumer then paying for a hard drive to keep those games on? Sure, but at the end of the day, that's still cheaper than making a physical cartridge.
I would disagree. I'm going to jump in here because I disagree. Because I think the cost of a content distribution network and the servers needed and the load that it takes to distribute a game, like I think you might be underplaying the cost of that. Like,
sure.
I mean, it is a data centers and server services are incredibly pricey for a reason. And when it comes to games, like, I mean, just to give you an idea, right, places like Google have had to build their own content delivery networks in order to deliver them as most efficiently as possible. So a lot of these solutions are custom. They work with the developers and the publishers to push these things out. So I do think that while it might, like, a physical item costs a lot, the digital infrastructure needed to push a game out online in a manner where anybody on launch day can download the game and not run into issues, I think that that is a cost that we might not have a full grasp of.
Yeah, sure. I don't want to, you know, speak out my butt here, but it's always been my understanding from the people I've spoken to in interviews, you know, proper game devs overseas, that even though the online infrastructure is expensive, it's still cheaper than putting physical discs and cartridges in stores. That's from what I understand. I'm welcome for anyone to prove me wrong, but I just wanted to bring up that fallacy in the past where we're talking about the development costs of games going up. And the last point I want to make about that, because I've been speaking for a while, is that they are saying, listen, we've got studios set up in expensive cities like San Francisco. We're paying people good wages. We're employing thousands of talented engineers and programmers or whatever. That is driving up the cost of gaming, which I agree with. That's fine. But I don't want to say that's not our problem, but it's one of those things where the company is reversing the problem on us. They are choosing to make the games like that, right?
Mm.
We maybe aren't. I know a big part of the public is asking for, you know, better graphics, better gameplay and everything, but if you're saying that your development costs are getting out of hand, how can that be our problem? That's your company. You have to deal with it. And another fallacy is that, oh, but, you know, it costs billions to run our company. How much of that money went to the CEO? How much of that money went to the studio to make the game? And how much money went to the executives to sit on a yacht? I don't want to hear that we have to increase the price of our games because it costs so much to make, but the money is going to somebody who's not actually involved in making the game. that's why, and I know all of the conversation we've had now is mostly AAA games and maybe AA games. If we're talking about indie, where the game is made by five people, when I pay $20 or $30 for that game, it's going to those guys who are making that game. It's not going to, what's his name, Bobby Kotick, to get his $200 million bonus this year. So I just wanted to talk about some of those fallacies that the companies are trying to push on us on why these prices have to go up when we talk about game development costs.
Yeah, so I think it's time to wrap this conversation up. Obviously, games aren't going to get any cheaper, but maybe they will. But to wrap up, what are your closing thoughts? Robin, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think transparency. I understand we've kind of spoken about costs and potentially what they are, what the fallacies are. But if there's transparency around how much a game costs to make, especially a AAA one, then I can understand whether or not I should be spending my money or not. If I know what these costs are going towards, if I know how much developers are getting paid and how much they really should be getting paid, then we start to have a different conversation. Understand the elements such as inflation that will impact pricing and stuff like that. But like Clinton's mentioned, the cost to produce, ship, store, and then sell a physical disc is not the same anymore because we're living in a digital age.
Mm.
It's easier for publishers to do things digitally. How is it not easier on my wallet then? So if there's greater transparency, potentially it makes this conversation easier to have. And then I know exactly where my money is being spent.
Clinton, your final thoughts?
If you are fed up of these prices, I don't want to say do your research because that's been co-opted by idiots. But I just want to say look around to things you might not consider. If you're on PlayStation and you're tired of paying that much for a game, look at what an Xbox costs or a PC costs and look at Game Pass. Weigh up your options. If you are someone who only buys new games when they're brand new and they're AAA and they cost more than R1,000, try look at second-hand games. Try look at AA games. Try look at indies. People, you got to support the indies. Some of the best games I've ever played are made by five people and not 500.
Mm.
I don't know why, but even in the modern day, people look past indies. They think if I spend more money on a game, I'm going to have a better experience. And that's been proven wrong time and again. Consider your options. Consider Game Pass, Xbox, and the indie space. If you're fed up with paying so much, there are options.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of sums up what I want to say as well. It's just that game subscriptions are the way forward. It's Microsoft has said a few times that Game Pass is a sustainable business model for them. They have no plans to increase the price. So it can be done. You can get a medium where you can produce great games and not charge people in an arm and a leg for it. So there is a solution to this, and charging R1,500 for ownership of a game is not it. All I can hope for is that PlayStation users get a subscription service either through PlayStation or some enterprising young folks who decide to go around PlayStation. So that will probably never happen because PlayStation is omnipotent. But yeah, we can only hope that PlayStation players get some subscription love as well, because this is the way that games are going. I mean, music has gone that way. Films and TV have gone that way. It's time for games to go that way as well, where once they were the leaders of industry, now we're not anymore. So come on, publishers, get clever. Get clever about how you sell games. Get clever about how you make games. Like Clinton said, you don't always need 500 people to work on a game. The ambitions are the ones that you create for yourselves, right? I mean, Hades is hands down one of the best games they've ever made, and that has a very short credits list compared to Outriders, which I've just kind of forgotten about. I think this is kind of an area where we're in flux at the moment, where there's a new generation of consoles, there's not many games, and the games that are there are very expensive. But hopefully in the future, we won't be having this conversation anymore. We'll be like, guys, don't you think we should be paying more for games? I feel bad that we're paying so little. But yeah, thank you so much for tuning in this week. We really appreciate it. From myself, Brendan Lodge, cheerio. From Clinton Matos.
Bye, everybody.
And from Robin Lucchetti.
Take care, everyone.
We'll see you next week. Cheerio.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.